for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the United States and Israel agree on the need to help keep Iran from getting nuclear weapons, but disagree on how to achieve that goal. The comments came Monday, a day before the Prime Minister is scheduled to make a speech to the U.S. Congress. Mr. Netanyahu says the disagreement with the United States grows out of different perspectives, because Washington worries about security, while Israel must worry about survival. Mr. Netanyahu said he respects President Obama and the relationship between Israel and the United States remains strong. He said as Prime Minister he has a moral obligation to point out the dangers of a nuclear-armed Iran. Iraqi troops and militia fighters attacked Islamic State militants in a key area north of Baghdad Monday, the first full day of a highly publicized offensive to recapture the city of Tikrit. Ground troops advanced on multiple fronts with support from airstrikes, military commander said. The operation includes an estimated 30,000 members of Iraq's military, Shiite militias, and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. The Islamic State group has held Tikrit since June, when the militants stormed across northern Iraq. That land grab also netted them Mosul, Iraq's second-largest city, located just north of Tikrit's Saladin province. In footage aired on Iranian television, a member of Iraq's forces held up an ammunition belt and said he is prepared to crush the IS militants, who overran the hometown of executed leader Saddam Hussein last year. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is urging the United Nations to investigate human rights abuses in separatist-controlled eastern Ukraine, where thousands of people have been killed in nearly a year of violence.
In Crimea and in the separatist-controlled areas of eastern Ukraine, men, women, and children are being killed. They're being tortured. They're being raped and sexually assaulted, detained arbitrarily, abducted for ransom, forced into labor, prosecuted and persecuted because of who they are and where they worship. It's up to the HRC to shed light on it and to help to hold accountable those who violate those human rights.
The top U.S. diplomat spoke Monday in Geneva to the U.N. Human Rights Council following talks with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. North Korea has fired two short-range missiles into the sea in an apparent protest against joint U.S. and South Korean military exercises launched Monday. South Korean officials said the missiles fell into the East Sea, 490 kilometers from the North Korean port city of Nambo. South Korean Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-suk said the incident was considered a deliberate provocation seen as an armed protest, as the North fired the missiles without designating a no-sail zone. Nigeria's Boko Haram militants have released a video showing the beheading of two men. The site intelligence group reported the release of the video Monday on its Twitter feed. A freeze frame from the video shows masked militants holding long knives standing behind two men seated on the ground. Boko Haram has killed thousands of people since launching its insurgency in 2009 and controls numerous towns in northeastern Nigeria. Bangladesh's anti-terrorism unit has arrested what it called the prime suspect in the killing of Avjit Roy, a prominent Bangladeshi-American blogger who wrote against religious fundamentalism. He was hacked to death in Dhaka last week. The Rapid Action Battalion arrested Farabi Shaifur Rahman in the capital Monday morning. Boston Marathon bombing suspect Johar Tsarnaev was due in court Monday with his defense lawyers and U.S. prosecutors arguing over last-minute legal issues before the start of his trial on Wednesday. Judge George O'Toole is considering requests by the lawyers to limit certain types of evidence in the case. The 21-year-old Tsarnaev is accused of killing four people and injuring another 264 with two homemade pressure cooker bombs at the finish line. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhiban coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The Mo Ibrahim Foundation has awarded its multi-million dollar African Leadership Prize to the outgoing president of Namibia. The prize, which aims to promote good governance, has also raised questions about whether African leaders need to be given cash incentives to do their jobs.
That's VOA's Gabe Jaslow reporting. Details next.
Also, a tragic mix-up in the Nigerian city of Bauchi yesterday led to a mob murdering a woman wrongfully suspected of being a suicide bomber.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the Mo Ibrahim Foundation has awarded its multi-million dollar African Leadership Prize to the departing president of Namibia. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports the prize, which aims to promote good governance, has also raised questions about whether African leaders need to be given cash incentives to do their jobs.
The 2014 Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership has been awarded to Namibian President Hifikepunye Pohamba, who is completing his second and final term in office this year. The chairperson of the prize committee, Salim Ahmed Salim, made the announcement at an event in Nairobi.
During the decade of President Pohamba's presidency, Namibia's reputation has been cemented as a well-governed, stable, and inclusive democracy, with the strong media freedom and respect for human rights.
The prize committee also recognized Mr. Pohamba's successful efforts to reduce the rates of HIV in his country, to extend free primary education to all of its citizens, and to promote gender equality in government. Mr. Pohamba has led Namibia since 2005. His successor is to be inaugurated later this month. The Namibian president is only the fifth recipient of the African Leadership Award and the first since former Cape Verde president Pedro Pires won in 2011. In the intervening years, the committee could find no other suitable candidates. The prize is the work of Mo Ibrahim, a Sudanese billionaire who made his money in mobile communications. Asked about whether it is right to give such a large cash prize to African leaders, given their reputation for wealth, Ibrahim said the purpose of the award is to draw greater attention to those humbler heads of state who are too often overlooked.
Even the winner today, how many of you heard about him before today? How many? Raise your hands. Look at you. Six people. Let us find our heroes and celebrate them. We have heroes in Africa. It's not only Mandela.
The foundation is also responsible for the Ibrahim Index of African Governance, which ranks countries based on factors including economic opportunity and human rights. The prize committee acknowledged Namibia, which ranks highly on the index, still faces challenges, including widening income inequality. Committee member Grasa Machel, the widow of former South African President Nelson Mandela, said these obstacles, shared by many countries in Africa, can also help distinguish good leadership.
And it's precisely because there are so many challenges that we have to recognize that despite the challenges, they were able to make progress. And that's the message which is being sent to all African leaders.
Mr. Pohamba will receive a $5 million prize plus $200,000 a year for the rest of his life. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
In the DRC, the army has killed at least 10 rebel fighters and captured 93 in a campaign to retake eastern territory from FDLR rebels. A spokesman says rebels are abandoning their weapons as the military seizes parts of north and south Kivu provinces. The FDLR, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, has been responsible for much of the conflict and violence in eastern Congo for two decades. It's estimated the group has about 1,400 members. Some took part in the 1994 genocide in Rwanda.
A tragic mix-up in the Nigerian city of Bauchi yesterday led to a mob murdering a woman wrongfully suspected of being a suicide bomber. Chris Stein reports from the capital, Abuja.
For the past several months, authorities at the Muda Lawal market in Bauchi have hired civilian guards, sometimes called vigilantes, to search incoming shoppers and vehicles as a way of protecting the market from gunmen and bombers. When a woman approached the entrance to the fruits and vegetables section wearing an overcoat, her refusal to be searched quickly turned deadly. Ibrahim Musa saw what happened. Musa says the vigilantes were suspicious of the woman from the moment they first saw her. They insisted she be searched, but she resisted, leading to an altercation with people in the market. Musa says she was escorted out and then came back along with a man in an army uniform. She resumed arguing with the vigilantes until the soldier left, at which point Musa says the vigilantes attacked her. They beat her, then put tires on her, and set her ablaze. No bomb was found on the woman's body. Like many cities in northeastern Nigeria, Bauchi has been bombed in recent months by the extremist group Boko Haram, which has been fighting to impose their strict version of Islamic law across the northeast. They've taken over swaths of the region and sent suicide bombers to assault public places, including a market in Bauchi in December. An offensive by multinational military forces in recent weeks has pushed Boko Haram out of some of their strongholds in the northeast. But security experts believe the insurgents will step up guerrilla tactics, like bombings, as they lose territory, particularly as the March 28th presidential election nears. Bawa Abdullahi Wase, a security analyst and associate at the Network for Justice, says the fear caused by Boko Haram's random bombing was a catalyst for the killing of the woman, who has still not been identified.
Nigerians should be prepared for more incidents like this because there is desperation. People want to cause confusion. People want to make sure that they disrupt the system of this election that is coming up this month at all costs. So as long as this be the case, as we know it is, then definitely people should be prepared to see more of this.
Police in Bauchi say they are looking for the people that killed the woman, but have made no arrests yet. Community leader Zubair Yakubu condemned the slaying.
As it turned out to be that she was not a Boko Haram member, this is a gruesome murder. And I will call on our people to please calm down. Don't take the laws into their hands.
Trading at the market continued as usual after the woman was killed. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Thank you, Chris. In other news from the region, in Cameroon's capital, thousands demonstrated in support of regional military forces waging battle against Boko Haram. Youths marched in the streets of Yaounde carrying signs supporting the troops of Chad and Cameroon. A leader of the demonstration also said the demonstrators were showing solidarity with millions of neighboring Nigerians. In recent weeks, about 200 Cameroon soldiers have died fighting Boko Haram forces in Cameroon and in Nigeria.
In Nigeria, observers say the two main parties are retooling their campaigns for the presidential polls, which were extended by 6 weeks to March 28th. Reporter William Eagle spoke to Gebenga Defeye about the extension and about issues that have emerged among the parties in the past few weeks. He's the editor-in-chief and general manager of the Vanguard newspaper in Lagos. Adefeye says, for example, that for some parties, the extension may mean a shortage of money for the additional weeks of campaigning.
It is expected that the postponement will harm the candidates, will harm the parties, because not all of them, not all the parties have deep pockets. Not all of them have the kind of resources that can take people through clearly two rounds of campaign, as we are not going to have in Nigeria, with the possible exception of the two major parties. And we even think that of the two major parties, of course, the main opposition party should be at a disadvantage because we expect that most of the funds coming to them should come from private pockets and a few of the state governments. And that should be insignificant compared to the ruling party that has been in power for 16 years. Oh, so sure, the postponement would have hurt them. That is also the reason why some of us imagine that they beat a retreat to go re-strategize and return to the field.
You say that the two parties may be strategizing now and they will resume their campaigns soon. Is there any indication of new strategies, new directions, or new ideas they may use when they begin campaigning?
Well, we don't know yet, but we do expect that the ruling party may this time around be seizing initiative to say that, yes, now we can assure you that we can take care of the insurgents and govern the country. Because that has been a major campaign point for the opposition. We expect also, because in before the retreat, you had a proper focus, a kind of demystification of the main opposition candidate, General Buhari, in terms of focusing on a kind of doing an integrity audit on the man, questioning the claims to his lack of corruption and all of that. So all of that we expect to change now. We do expect that this ruling party should come out stronger. So the opposition party also have to firm up on its own campaign strategy, devise new questions and answers for the ruling party, if only to get the attention of the electorate.
Retired General Buhari has said that he would consider releasing details of his personal wealth, that he would consider an audit. Is that something that is likely to gain traction? The APC and General Buhari challenging President Jonathan to release his as well.
The law in Nigeria requires that aspirants to public offices should release the details of their wealth to the Code of Conduct Bureau. Now, former President Musa Yar'Adua went a step further to actually do a public declaration, putting his work in public domain. At that point in time, may have compared the sitting president now to follow suit. I think one other person that did that would have been the governor of Ekiti State, former governor of Ekiti State, Dr. Kayode Fayemi, who had a strong civil society background. The other people generally have not been doing that, and I do not think that even if General Buhari declares his assets publicly, that the others are going to follow suit.
Gbenga, last week, General Buhari went to London, where he spoke at the think tank called Chatham House. The opposition says, however, that he may have really been there for medical reasons. Is there any evidence at all that he has any medical problems? And what reason did the APC give for his going to London?
Well, the APC said, well, there was a break because of the postponement of the election, and that he had this invitation to come and do this public speaking at the think tank. That was the official position of the APC. And as we speak, we really do not have evidence yet of his being sick or being hospitalized. And what we do expect the people in the ruling party to do, if they really believe that General Buhari is sick, is to get his medical records into public domain, not the kind of accusation that is made on the podium.
Has General Buhari or his team said that they would release his medical records?
No, they haven't. All they have said is that the man is as fit as the fiddle and is strong enough to govern Nigeria.
As a newspaper man, as an editor, what are you looking for in the next few weeks? What are you expecting to happen?
Well, we expect to have a more exacting campaign. We expect the ruling party to respond more to issues of development, especially with the kind of intervention that came from the former governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, Professor Charles Soludo, who had tried to redirect the attention of the parties to the issue of the economy. So we expect them to focus more on issues of the economy, of security, of national development, and all of that. So instead of just trading abuses, which they have done largely in the last few weeks.
That was the editor-in-chief of the Vanguard newspaper in Lagos, Gbenga Defai. He was speaking to reporter William Eagle.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on The Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. The Mo Ibrahim Foundation has awarded its multi-million dollar African Leadership Prize to the departing president of Namibia. And a tragic mix-up in the Nigerian city of Bauchi yesterday led to a mob murdering a woman wrongfully suspected of being a suicide bomber. and we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The acting president of Sierra Leone is under a self-imposed quarantine. Vice President Samuel Sam Sumana began a 21-day quarantine last Tuesday following the death from Ebola of one of his security guards. He assumed executive powers yesterday as President Ernest Bai Koroma left for a European Union conference in Belgium. Mr. Sam Sumana is the highest-ranking African official to be quarantined in West Africa for Ebola. In Guinea, the anti-Ebola campaign has shifted more attention to working with traditional healers. There has been some violent resistance, including killings, to the presence of health educators, health workers, and burial teams in parts of the country. The World Health Organization says as a result of the shift in campaigns, traditional healers are referring more patients to treatment centers. The WHO says there have been nearly 24,000 Ebola cases since the outbreak began and more than 9,700 deaths.
A new report says sub-Saharan Africans rate their health and healthcare systems among the worst in the world. Nevertheless, improving health is not their top priority. VOA's Jody Kapawa reports.
The report's been released as Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone continue to fight the Ebola outbreak, a situation that was made worse by the poor state of their health systems. Angus Deaton is co-author of the study.
I think most of us thought these episodes burnt out very quickly, and this one didn't, and I think that was surprising to a lot of people. But, and this is relevant for our work, healthcare systems in sub-Saharan Africa are very poorly organized and very badly done. And of course, that certainly contributed to the difficulties of bringing it under control.
Deaton is Dwight D. Eisenhower, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. It's important, he says, to understand what Africans list as their top priorities.
People in Africa don't think of health as their highest priority, at least for the government, whereas most aid agencies have been prioritizing health pretty heavily.
He summarizes the views of sub-Saharan Africans based on the findings of Gallup's annual world polls.
They perceive their health pretty badly. They perceive their overall well-being pretty badly. Well-being is broader than just health. So, you know, many people sort of think, well, if you lived in a poor country all your life, you're used to it by now, and you'd be just about as happy as everybody else. But if you ask people how their lives are going, sub-Saharan Africans rate those very poorly. So they know that life could be better.
Deaton says the same is true of their perceptions of health care.
Can you imagine a healthcare system that spends about $100 a year per person? That's not going to deliver very much healthcare.
So, if improving poor healthcare systems is not the top priority among Africans, what is?
If you ask them what government should be doing for them, they want money and jobs more than they want health, which is interesting. And I think it has something to do with the fact that there's a lot of morbidity and mortality in Africa.
During the early years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in Africa, health workers say many infected people wanted food more than medical care. They knew the disease would take years to kill them, but a lack of food could do it much sooner. The findings show jobs are more important because they have an immediate effect on people's well-being.
Some countries, less than half of the population has ever had any contact whatsoever with a health professional. That's pretty amazing, and there's certainly differences in that across countries. So you get a country like Sudan or Somaliland, where it's less than half, and then you get places like Benin or Madagascar, where 90%, or Senegal, where more than 90% of the people have had some contact with the health system somewhere in their lives. So there's a huge amount of variability across Africa.
After an initial slow response to the West Africa Ebola outbreak, the international community poured in a lot of money and resources. Some observers say this will allow Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone not only to get better health care systems, but to maintain them. Deaton doubts this. and says they could easily slip back to pre-Ebola conditions.
I don't think just very easily. I'd be stunned if it didn't happen. The fundamental problem is just incapacity of the state.
The Princeton professor says donors and aid agencies should take the study's findings seriously. They show that 31% chose jobs as their top priority, while 21% picked improving agriculture. Nearly 14.5% chose tackling corruption, while 13.5% decided on education and health care. Just over 6% chose electricity as the top priority. The study says those who chose jobs in agriculture shared an underlying factor, better livelihoods. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. Discrimination, racism, Islamophobia, and anti-Semitism are among the many issues to be explored at the new session of the UN Human Rights Council. The four-week meeting is opening with a four-day high-level segment during which senior officials will discuss issues of national interest and global concern. Lisa Schlein reports from the council meeting in Geneva.
By video link from New York, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon weighed in on the importance of nations to do their utmost to combat human rights violations, which continue to escalate in many parts of the world.
The world faces serious violations of human rights, from discrimination and inequality to oppression and violent extremism. Our shared challenge is to do far more to keep these and other abuses from occurring in the first place. The conflict in Syria offers just one example where early United Nations efforts to address human rights violations might have averted a human and political catastrophe.
Ban says the United Nations has the mandate and tools to prevent such disasters. Unfortunately, he notes, these tools often go unused because countries, for political reasons, cannot agree on what action to take. In the case of Syria, the United Nations estimates more than 200,000 people have been killed in this conflict, which is entering its fifth year. It says 12.2 million Syrians are in need of aid, including the 7.6 million internally displaced people. Another 4 million Syrians have sought refuge in neighboring countries. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayd Raad al-Hussein opened the council with a criticism of countries, he said, often put their own interests ahead of the human rights of their citizens. He said he's especially disturbed by the contempt and disregard displayed by several states towards the women and men appointed by them as independent experts and by the reprisals and smear campaigns frequently targeted against them.
Some policymakers persuade themselves that their circumstances are exceptional, creating a wholly new reality unforeseen by the law. This logic is abundant around the world today. In reality, neither terrorism, nor globalization, nor migration are qualitatively new threats that can justify overturning the legal foundations of life on Earth. They are not new.
The High Commissioner says it is the duty and responsibility of governments to protect the rights of their people, not deprive them of these rights. Highlights of the four-week council session include presentations by the Independent Commissions of Inquiry on Syria, Eritrea, and the 2014 Gaza conflict. It will present reports on the human rights situation in Iraq in light of abuses committed by the so-called Islamic State, and will discuss the situations in North Korea, Iran, Burma, Central African Republic, Ivory Coast, and Mali, among others. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiy Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Mo Ibrahim Foundation awards its multi-million dollar African Leadership Prize to the departing president of Namibia. The DRC Army kills at least 10 rebel fighters and captures 93 in a campaign to retake the eastern territory from FDLR rebels. And the acting president of Sierra Leone is under a self-imposed Ebola quarantine. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, the Economic Community of Central African States is determined to find ways of reducing cyber criminality and terrorism. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with the Cricket World Cup.
Kim, the Cricket World Cup resumes on Tuesday when South Africa faces Ireland in Canberra, Australia. The Proteas of South Africa enter the one-day international with 4 points from 3 matches. They're second in the Pool B table behind India, which has 6 points from 3 matches. Ireland is third in the table. The Irish have 4 points, like South Africa, but have played one less match. In Cricket World Cup action Sunday, South Africa's neighbor Zimbabwe lost to Pakistan by 20 runs. The final score from Brisbane Cricket Ground in Australia, Pakistan 235 for 7 in 50 overs, and Zimbabwe 215 for 49.4 overs. Pakistan's captain, Misbah ul Haq, talks about his team's victory.
I think team fought really well, especially credit goes to the bowlers. They just kept the pressure, kept taking wickets. That's the key in this World Cup. Even if you are just defending a low total, if you have the bowlers who could take wickets at different intervals, you could really just penetrate. And that's what especially the fast bowlers did today.
It was Pakistan's first win at the Cricket World Cup after 2 losses. Meanwhile, it was the 3rd defeat for the Chevrons of Zimbabwe, who beat the United Arab Emirates by 4 wickets on February 19th. For their only victory so far in the tournament. Zimbabwe's captain, Brendan Taylor, had this to say after the loss to Pakistan.
Again, we've found ways to get out at crucial periods, some soft dismissals as well. So that's been a major downfall for us in the last 4 games. It was difficult to score, but it needed a partnership, and unfortunately, you know, 50s or 30 partnerships, they're not going to get you over the line. So it was it's extremely difficult to comprehend this loss. I think there's a few mental flaws as individual players that is costing us at crucial periods.
That's Brendan Taylor, the 29-year-old captain of Zimbabwe's national cricket team, and he spoke from Brisbane, Australia. From Brisbane, the Chevrons of Zimbabwe now travel to Hobart, Australia, where they'll play Ireland March 7th in their next match. Remember, VOA Cricket World Cup fans, the top 4 teams in each of the 2 pools will advance to the quarterfinals, which will be played between March 18th and March 21st. Taking a quick look at the standings, Cricket World Cup co-host New Zealand tops Group A with the maximum 8 points from 4 matches, followed by Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and co-host Australia. India is on top of Group B with the maximum 6 points from 3 matches, followed by South Africa, Ireland, and the West Indies. We'll be right back. In African youth football, here's a sunny side of sports salute to Mali's national under-17 team, which lifted the Continental Trophy on Sunday in Niamey, Niger. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma reports.
Second half goals scored by Siaka Bagayoko and Ale Male powered Mali to a 2-0 win over South Africa in the finals of the Africa Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger on Sunday. Earlier on at the same venue, Guinea beat FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria 3-1 in the bronze medal playoff. Abubakar Toure found the back of the net before Abdoulaye Jules added a brace for Guinea, while Victor James scored for Nigeria. In all, 43 goals were scored in the two-week tournament. Nigerian Victor James is the top scorer with 4 goals. Guinea's Abubakar Toure, Nigerian Kelechi Nwakali, and Mali's Abubakar Traore tie in second place with 3 goals each, while Cameroon's Christian Bayem, Guinea's Abdoulaye Jules, Ivory Coast's Idrissa Doumbia, Malian's Sekou Koita and Ale Male, South African's Eric Mayo and Nelson Maluleke, together with Zambian Patson Daka, each scored 2 goals. In athletics, Robert Chemosin triumphed at the Rome to Ostia half marathon in Italy on Sunday. What's more, his winning time of 59 minutes and 37 seconds is the quickest half marathon in the world this year. Fellow Kenyan Simon Cheprot was second in 59 minutes and 39 seconds, while Godfrey Kisuro was third in a Uganda national record of 59 minutes and 43 seconds. Meanwhile, Ethiopian Amane Beriso and Kenyan Emily Chemutai Ngetich claimed the top 2 spots in the women's race in lifetime bests of 1 hour and 8 minutes and 43 seconds and 1 hour and 9 minutes and 13 seconds, respectively, as Kenyan Sharon Cherop placed third. Elsewhere, Kenyan Samuel Ndungu clocked 2 hours, 9 minutes and 8 seconds to win the Lake Biwa Marathon in Japan on Sunday. Ndungu also won the race in 2012.
Because this is Africa. Samina, mina, ele, waka, waka, ele. Samina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Because
this is Africa. Samina, mina, ele, waka, waka, ele. Samina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
English golfer Andy Sullivan is the 2015 Johannesburg Open champion. Reporter Nick Dye tells us more from South Africa's commercial capital.
England's Andy Sullivan is the Joburg Open champion after a final round 66 left him on 17 under par and victory by 2 shots over a host of players on 15 under, headed up by the Irishman Kevin Phelan. Sullivan survived going in the water on the par 4 11th to recover with 2 birdies in his final 7 holes to clinch his second title in the city this year, having won the South African Open at the Glendowner Golf Club just after Christmas.
I don't know, I just love coming down here and just seem to play really well. You know, after Thursday as well, shooting level par, I didn't think it had much of a chance of winning, and then to be coming in the league, coming down the last few holes is a lovely feeling, and I really enjoyed it. Me and Macca out there today, we had fun again, you know me, on that back nine. We just really enjoyed ourselves, and felt like we played probably a bit better than we did yesterday, and probably hit some really good shots down the stretch there as well.
We talked about consistency on this course, and when it's that tight at the top, you must have feared the worst when you hit the water, but you made a great recovery from that.
Yeah, I mean, it was just one of them. It was just a funny line. It just didn't come out how I expected it. So, but I played great for 10 holes, so it wasn't nothing to fret about. I thought if I just carry on in the manner I was started with, I'd be okay, and I got myself back in there and ended up winning it, which is nice. Always seem to having a come from behind seems to be my trait at the moment, but I'll take everyone.
You talked about enjoying yourself on the golf course. Does that help if you do play a particularly bad shot because you're not particularly fretting about it for too long?
No, definitely. I think that's just my personality. I just want to enjoy myself out there, and keeps me relaxed, and I seem to play my best golf out here, especially in SA at the moment. But it's all for me. If I can't enjoy coming down the stretch there with the lead, you're struggling.
The added bonus for Sullivan, as well as winning, is a place at this year's Open Championship at St Andrews in July. The other 2 places filled by fellow Englishman Anthony Wall and David Howell, who both finished tied second at 15 under par, but qualified by virtue of their higher world ranking. It's Sullivan, though, that came out on top once again in Johannesburg, won 17 under par.
Thanks, Nick. That's Nick Dye reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Joining us now with more African football news is the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shegun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi.
Good evening, Africa. Coach Stephen Keshi says a new deal offered to him by the Nigeria Football Federation, NFF, amounts to, quote, a slave contract, unquote. From the clauses I've seen so far, I don't know what words to use, but the contract can be described as a slave contract. The French news agency, AFP, quoted Keshi as saying, the coach may have been referring to clauses which make him answerable to several persons and committees. AFP reports that Keshi has now been offered a two-year contract, effective March 1st, 2015. He's required to meet several targets and also sign a code of conduct. Keshi himself reveals he will be paid 5 million naira, or less than $25,000 per month, the same salary he received during his initial contract. Last week, the former Togo and Mali coach lost out to Franco-German Jeannot Rohr in the race to handle Burkina Faso. A debate has raged on whether Keshi, who is 52, should be given a new contract after he failed to qualify the Super Eagles for the recent Africa Cup of Nations in Equatorial Guinea. His initial contract of 3 years ran out after the 2014 FIFA World Cup in Brazil, at which Nigeria reached the last 16, where it was eliminated by France. In African club football, one of the 17 teams that have advanced to the first round of the CAF Confederation Cup is the Dolphins Football Club of Nigeria. The team defeated Leones Vegetarianos of Equatorial Guinea on Saturday in Nigeria's oil city of Port Harcourt. Score at full-time was 1-1, but the Nigerians prevailed 5-4 on penalties. Abindeng Loron is the technical director of Leones Vegetarianos. After the match, he commended his team for its determination, despite being new to the continental tournament.
Very good match, determination for the two teams, and something remained to my players. It's a young team, and they get small experience because it's the first time they can play to the CAF competitions. I have Dolphin is a good team, a very good team, and they get experience.
That was Sebin De Gloron, the technical director of Leones Vegetarianos Football Club of Equatorial Guinea. Many thanks to reporter Tony Tamuno for the audio. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
And many thanks to you, Segun, for that report. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. And my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, the Economic Community of Central African States determined to find ways of reducing cyber criminality and terrorism. And next, millions of people around East Africa face risks from climate change. But first, some music. Here is Rocky Awuni of Ghana with Master Plan.
Outside your gates, Local leaders to this brand new way. Then say let go of favorite trouble. Hand in hand we carry each other. Come on people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Come on people, meditate, go higher. Ghana people, make you take it, go higher. Come Africa, make you light my fire. And I'll be proud. I could not believe the news today. Another hero South Africa. Wipe your tears and fears away. All you children from Africa, Jamaica, sing new songs of joy and redemption. Wave your flags in celebration. Come on people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now.
Ghana's Roky Awuni with the master plan.
Well, cybersecurity experts from the 10 member states of the Economic Community of Central African States recently met in Cameroon to determine ways of reducing cyber criminality and terrorism. Members say the threat of terrorism is high, and the states have agreed to improve collaboration and organizational commitment in fighting electronic crime. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon says it is investigating a network of cyber criminals who have penetrated computer systems and networks to hack into personal and corporate bank accounts. Ntang Bay Emir of Cameroon's Judicial Police told VOA some of the suspects have diverted millions of dollars from corporate and private bank accounts.
De plus en plus, les guichets automatiques sont la cible des cyberattaques. Nous avons des gens, j'ai eu à déférer des Nigériens.
He says automatic teller machines are increasingly becoming the targets of cyber criminals. He says he is investigating three Nigerians and a Ghanaian who were arrested with new Visa cards that they use to tap information from ATM machines and then have access to their victims' passwords. Marcel Abiana Belinge, representative of the Commonwealth Telecommunication Organization at the forum, says cyber criminality in Central Africa is no longer just an economic threat.
The security of nation state is a wide and growing problem. Hacking is one of them, cyber espionage, even just data loss. You have government civil servants who lose USB sticks with key information as a result of inefficiency within government or because of the efficiency, if you so want, of the attackers. You personally may be logged onto a Wi-Fi network and you have no idea that the person next to you is actually logging everything that you're doing. There is around 800 million people in the world who are estimated to have been a victim at least one of identity theft.
Jean-Jacques Messina, director of the Central African Zone of the International Telecommunication Union, IUT, says Central African states are increasingly victims of cyber crimes because they lack the necessary manpower and equipment and detection systems. The 10 member states of the Economic Community of Central African States agreed to be aggressive in pursuing perpetrators and prosecute them to the full extent of the law. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
As the world gears up for a new global treaty on climate change in December of this year, experts warn that millions of people around East Africa are faced with risks from climate change. Major risks include changing disease patterns, extreme weather events, and the threat to food and water security. From the Kenyan capital, correspondent Ruben Chama reports.
Scientists from the United Nations-affiliated Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, are warning East African nations to brace themselves for extreme weather events related to climate change. Guled Atan, director of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development Climate Prediction and Applications Center, ICPAC, was a participant at a recent regional meeting on climate attended by representatives from the IGAD member states.
One thing is for sure, that man has an effect on climate, it's for sure. And temperature is increasing. The problem in East Africa is serious. When there is a rain, the rain will be more intense, so there will be more floods. The dry spells will be wider, so there will be more droughts. That is the risk. So increase likelihood of drought, increase likelihood of floods. Two extremes. Too much water, too little water.
Dr. Chris Field and Dr. Yuba Sokona are both members of working groups on the panel that deals with flooding and other effects on climate change. They said the extremes in rainfall mentioned by Mr. Atan could also mean a change in the patterns of infectious diseases and also food production. Dr. Sokona said waiting to adapt to climate change requires international cooperation, and he said that waiting to implement measures to deal with the phenomena would be costly. Dr. Alice Kauda, Kenya's Environment Secretary at the Ministry of Environment, Water and Natural Resources, said Kenya is already implementing laws and policies to tackle the problem. She says the government has introduced regulatory mechanisms that require households that consume, for instance, 100 liters of water per day to install solar panels. Households with the panels receive tax rebates. She says Kenya also has a regulation requiring households to set aside at least 10% of their land for planting trees. Sarah O'Keefe is a researcher at the University of Oxford, currently working on a climate change-related project for Africa. She said countries can learn from each other by sharing best practices and experience.
What's interesting about climate change is that we're all kind of in this together. We're all tackling this issue at about the same time, and we're all grappling with how to identify the role that greenhouse gases are playing in these events and how to adapt efficiently and effectively to these changes. So I actually think that developed countries are learning just as much from developing countries as vice versa. I think that in terms of identifying impacts, trying out different adaptation measures, African countries are actually in some cases leading the way.
She says developed and developing countries are learning from each other, but adds that Africa is playing a leading role identifying the impact of climate change and trying out different measures to adapt to it. Reporting for VOA News, this is Ruben Chama in Nairobi.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Most recently, he has claimed credit for the kidnapping of more than 200 young girls from a school in Chibok and is threatening to sell them. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is also known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Skikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shekau. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing the African hospitality. This light-hearted show discusses topics of your interest with some clarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30.